Okay, so good morning, Bio 241, February 28th. Everybody's here. It's so nice we have lectures so late in the day. We're mostly awake by 11:30. I think that's great. You're not? Okay, well, you had lab this morning. All right, well, here we see a chemical reaction. Remember, we have reactants going to products through some kind of chemical reaction, right? So you got a couple reactants combining, like A plus B going to C plus D. What do we have on this diagram? Oh, just reactants and products, all right? And it's plotted versus energy. And we're comparing a catalyzed reaction, a non-catalyzed reaction with a catalyzed reaction over here. All right, so we can see that whether it's non-catalyzed or catalyzed, what's the energy of the reactants? It's the exact same energy, right? So if we look at this, at this axis right here, it's the same energy. All right, and whether it's a non-catalyzed or catalyzed reaction, what's the energy of the products? It's exactly the same, right? So the enzyme doesn't change the amount of energy in this particular case. Is energy consumed or released with this chemical reaction? It's released, right? And what do we call that kind of reaction? That's an exergonic reaction, right? So the only thing an enzyme does is it changes the activation energy. It doesn't change how much energy is released by this chemical reaction. It just speeds up the rate because it lowers the activation energy, right? And you can see that in the non-catalyzed reaction, it takes more energy to get up over this barrier, but that energy is then given back to the system, right? So this energy just cancels out. You have to put some in, but you get the exact same amount back out when the reaction takes place. All right, but if you calculate the amount of energy released by this exergonic reaction, whether it's non-catalyzed or catalyzed, it's exactly the same amount. So the only thing that this enzyme does is what it speeds up the rate of this reaction because it reduces the amount of energy that's necessary to get it to proceed. Okay, so that's kind of, it seems like a really subtle point for a lot of students. I just wanted to make sure that I go back over that once again. We got a couple other slides to go over on this particular chapter. All right, we were talking about coupling reactions. All right, in order to make ATP, that's an endergonic reaction. How can an endergonic reaction take place in your body? Like, if the reactants have less energy compared to the products, how do you get this little wheel turning right here? Okay, it's got to be coupled to an exergonic reaction, and there's got to be additional energy that can be used to create entropy in the system. So if these wheels were exactly the same size, it won't happen. Or if the blue wheel right here is smaller than this gray wheel, it won't happen. The blue wheel has to be bigger, right? There has to be more available energy in order to make an endergonic reaction take place. So the reactions that release energy are exergonic. And sometimes we break down large molecules into small molecules that releases a lot of energy. That extra energy can be used to put two small molecules together to make a bigger molecule, like an ADP and inorganic phosphate can be joined together to make a bigger molecule, namely ATP, right, if it's coupled to an exergonic reaction. All right, so here is that ATP molecule. It's an adenine nucleotide, but it's got three phosphate groups. Oh, we were talking about this last time. All right, so it's got three phosphate groups, hence adenosine triphosphate. And some of these bonds between the phosphate groups, between the alpha and the beta, that's a high energy phosphate, and between the beta phosphate and the gamma phosphate right here, that's another high energy bond. So when this ATP is broken down, how would you break this chemical bond down? What kind of reaction would you use? Yeah, hydrolysis reaction, right? It's just a nice simple hydrolysis reaction. Then the energy in this covalent bond is released and it can be used to drive other kinds of reactions taking place in your body. All right, so that's, and most chemical reactions have receptors for ATP, so ATP can be used as a universal energy carrier inside cells. Not that there aren't other high energy molecules inside your cells, but most enzymes have receptor sites for ATP, so ATP can be used as an energy source. All right, another class of reactions, oxidation reduction reactions. We'll have to define what these things are, but we're talking about molecules. And if a molecule gains an electron, we say it becomes reduced. And if a molecule loses electrons, then we say that it's oxidized. All right, and these two processes are always coupled together. A molecule can't lose an electron unless, what happens? Another molecule gains that particular electron. So you can't donate an electron unless somebody wants to accept it. So sometimes we call these oxidation reduction reactions because they're always coupled to each other. Right? So a reducing agent is some kind of molecule that can donate electrons to another molecule. And what happens to a reducing agent when it donates electrons? It becomes, it's a little tricky to figure this out, so I'm going to think before I say it. A reducing agent, when it donates electrons, becomes oxidized, right? And an oxidizing agent accepts electrons. So, for instance, when an oxidizing agent accepts an electron, what happens to it? It becomes reduced, all right? It's sort of like a little riddle, but look at it a bunch of times. But always just remember these two definitions right here. And just take your time on the test and refer to these two definitions. When a molecule gains an electron, it becomes reduced. And when it loses, it becomes oxidized. All right, and like I said, they're always coupled together. One reaction can't take place without the other. And this is the definition I really want you to focus on, and it hinges on the movement of electrons. All right, and sometimes your book talks about the transfer of hydrogen atoms instead, which are cations. But if we don't want to have a change in the charge of a molecule, okay, if an electron is donated, if a molecule gains an electron, but we don't want the electrical charge to change, what else has to go along with that electron so that the charge of the molecule doesn't change? Yeah, a proton, right? So these are kind of equivalent ways of looking at the same process. Whether you're looking at electrons or hydrogen atoms, it's really the same thing, except one is a negative charge, one is a positive charge. All right, and coenzymes play important roles as we have hydrogen ion carriers, but I think I would like for you to focus on electrons. They're carriers of electrons, and in particular, high-energy electrons. Right, and some of these are what we call NAD, and others are what we call FAD. I'm not even sure I want you to know what the name of these acronyms stand for. All right, but these are nucleotides, and the D right here means it's a dinucleotide. There are two nucleotides, and they're all based on adenine, and we're going to look at the formula of these things. These are large organic compounds, right? They're not small metal ions. And what do we call a large organic molecule that carries something from one set of chemical reactions to another? That's a coenzyme, right? So that's why we use that in this term right here. Here are two important coenzymes. You would not want to call these things co-what? Cofactors, because cofactors are small metal ions, right? And in our bodies, in human bodies, we can't synthesize these compounds anymore, so they are vitamins. Right, so a vitamin is a large organic molecule that we have lost the ability to produce in our bodies, but it's necessary to run the biochemistry inside ourselves. So where do you find these vitamins? How do you get these vitamins if you can't build them? Yeah, they have to be in your diet. Right, so these things are like A and B vitamins that we need. So this is the structure of what they look like. Okay, NAD plus, and actually, every place, a lot of times in your book, it's just written NAD, but I think it would be helpful for you to realize that it's actually NAD plus. It's an ion. That's in the oxidized state. Okay. When it's reduced, what happens to NAD plus when it becomes reduced? It accepts electrons. As a matter of fact, it accepts two electrons and a hydrogen, all right, and it becomes NADH as a result of that. So NAD plus is the oxidized state. When it accepts electrons, it becomes NADH. It has an extra proton. And you can see where these electrons actually bind to this molecule right here. But you're probably familiar. I see a nice 5-carbon sugar right here. That's an adenine. And then we got a couple of phosphates. It sort of looks like ATP, but it's missing a phosphate. But these are just related compounds. The other molecule is FAD. And again, in an oxidized state, it can accept electrons. When it accepts electrons, then two protons go along with it, and electrons are incorporated into the structure of FADH2. And FADH2 is carrying high energy electrons that it can donate to other chemical processes inside your body. So NADH is carrying high energy electrons, and FADH2 is carrying high energy electrons that it can donate. Okay, and when it donates those electrons to something, that something becomes reduced, and then FADH then becomes oxidized. Right, when FADH2 becomes oxidized, it becomes FAD once again. Okay, when it donates those electrons. And when NADH donates two electrons, it becomes oxidized, and it becomes what? NAD plus. Okay, so these are just typical oxidation reduction reactions that are taking place inside your body. NADH and FAD are important carriers for electrons. All right, so that's it for this chapter. So those last two pictures of NAD and FADH that I gave you are not exam figures. You don't have to memorize those structures, all right? But you should know something about at least those acronyms. Okay, so let's open up the next one. I opened it already. It's down here someplace off the screen. Ah, good enough. All right, chapter 5. Nice. Okay, so cell respiration and metabolism. This is biochemistry, so it's a little bit of a continuation on yet with some chemistry. These are some things we're going to look at: glycolysis, aerobic respiration, and then a little bit of fat and protein metabolism. All right, glyco refers to sugar. What does lysis refer to? Yeah, the breaking down of something, right? And so glycolysis is the breaking down of sugar, and in particular, glucose. Glycolysis is the breaking down of glucose. Can anybody remember how many carbon atoms are there in a glucose molecule? There are 6, right? And glycolysis is going to snip glucose exactly in half. So what are the two molecules that result from glycolysis? How many carbon atoms do they have? Okay, they're going to be 2-3 carbon atoms, right? So glucose has 6, we split it in half, you're going to end up with 2-3 carbon molecules. All right, so we're going to look at a couple of these details in this chapter. All right, but let's define metabolism. Metabolism is just all the chemical reactions that are taking place in your body. That's what metabolism means, right? So it's all the reactions in your body that involve energy transformations. And probably any kind of chemical reaction. I wouldn't even be so specific, because all reactions have transfers of energy. All right, and can be divided into two categories, catabolism and anabolism. Catabolism is the process that breaks down large molecules into small ones. Catabolism is breaking large into small. For instance, like glycolysis, you have a big molecule like glucose, you break it down into 2-3 carbon molecules. And that releases energy. So from what you know about energy reactions, what kind of reaction is that if it releases? That's an exergonic reaction, right? So catabolism are exergonic. And when we take large molecules and break them down, your body can couple that to the making of ATP. It can take that energy that's being released and regenerate ATP. Okay, so catabolism is the primary source of energy for making ATP in your body. Anabolism is just the reverse of that process, where we take small molecules, okay, and makes larger ones. So taking small, like maybe an inorganic phosphate and an ADP, and making an ATP molecule out of it. That would be anabolism. All right, so the source of the body's large energy storage compounds, for instance, like glycogen, is made when we take small molecules of glucose and add them together to make a glycogen. That takes some energy to make glycogen. Okay, so try to remember these two separate terms. And then here is a really important slide that you should focus on when you're studying pretty much everything in this chapter. This diagram describes everything that's happening in this chapter. So let's go over it, and it's an important extra credit lab quiz diagram. All right, so here we have a layer that looks red to me. This signifies blood that's flowing through your blood vessel someplace, right? So here's a blood compartment. And what about blood glucose? What do you know about blood glucose? Is it important to maintain under homeostatic control? Absolutely, okay? All right, so blood glucose shouldn't go up too high or go down too low, but it's going to vary a little bit over the course of a day. And let's look at the two possible conditions that a person can be in. So above the blood, we have a couple organ systems. We have the digestive system here, and then we also have the liver, and most people really consider a liver part of the digestive system, but let's just think of it as a standalone organ. Both can put glucose into the blood, right, depending on what state you're in. So after a meal, when you're in a fed state, and on your diagrams you could jot that down, fed state, right, you have nutrients in your digestive tract, they're being absorbed, and when they're absorbed, where do they go? Into the blood, right? All right, and when they go from your digestive tract into the blood, what happens to blood glucose? It increases, right? Okay. So that's a pretty good situation, but you're could also be in another state. There's a period of time when you don't eat anything for hours and hours on end, maybe 10 hours even. So there are no nutrients in your digestive tract to put glucose into the blood, so blood glucose is going to start to go down. But of course, there's important mechanisms that prevent that from happening. Where could a person go, where could a person's body go to get glucose to put in the blood when you're in a, when you're in a fasted state? So you got fed over here, and then over here you want to put fasted state. So those are the two states that you're going to be working with. Where could your body go in a fasted state to put glucose in the blood? The liver, because the liver has the storage form of glucose, namely glycogen, and that glycogen is a big molecule. It can be broken down, right, into glucose, and then the liver is a very altruistic organ. It's one of the few that will actually give up its own glucose to other organs in the body. So the liver gives up glucose that goes in the blood that maintains blood glucose level even though you're in a fasted state and none is being absorbed by the released by the digestive tract. Okay. So here we have glucose in the blood. It's going to leave the blood, and then we have a cell right here. And we have cytoplasm in this lighter color. Kind of looks beige to me, right? So this is just this is just cytosol. And then we have a little bit darker kind of beige color. This is now signifying mitochondria. So we have a couple different compartments with inside a cell, right? So glucose enters a cell, and in the cytoplasm, glucose can be broken down by glycolysis, right? That's what glycolysis means, into 2 3-carbon units, and these 3-carbon units are called pyruvic acid. And the most important thing is not drawn on this particular slide. And by the end of this week, I want you to tell me what this process is really producing for a cell or for you. And it's not even on this slide. Then maybe if you know what it is, don't say what it is right now. On Thursday, you could tell me, okay? All right, so glycolysis producing something for the cell. And pyruvate has a couple of different fates. And pyruvate can, under anaerobic conditions, produce lactic acid. And anaerobic conditions mean what? Without oxygen, right? So this, so glycolysis can happen without oxygen inside the cell, right? If pyruvate or pyruvic acid gets converted into lactic acid. All right, so I use these terms interchangeably. Pyruvate and pyruvic acid are exactly the same compound. Lactate and lactic acid are exactly the same compound, and I don't pay attention as to when I use one as compared to the other. And we have in here a little note saying in skeletal muscle. For instance, when skeletal muscle is working very rapidly, very hard, it's depleting those cells of oxygen, and when a muscle is contracted, blood can't even get into that muscle because it's just an incredibly hard, solid mass right there. And then oxygen isn't being delivered to that tissue, so that's operating under anaerobic conditions. So pyruvic acid is going to be converted into lactic acid when that happens. But if oxygen is available, then pyruvic acid can enter an organelle inside the cell, fortunately, that we have, is what? Mitochondria. So pyruvic acid can enter mitochondria, and there it's going to enter a couple other kinds of chemical pathways. There's a preparatory reaction before it enters the Krebs cycle, right? So that's one, a preparatory reaction. And then pyruvic acid becomes decarboxylated, so a carboxyl group comes off. that turns into CO2, and then that two-carbon unit, which we call an acetyl group, enters the Krebs cycle, and through a number of steps of the Krebs cycle, that two-carbon fragment is completely converted into more carbon dioxide. All right, and some of these electrons then, and these processes here, are captured and carried over to another biochemical pathway that we call the electron transport chain. All right, and in so doing, oxygen is necessary for this to happen, so we call these steps right here aerobic respiration. So when pyruvic acid enters the mitochondria, then it becomes part of the aerobic respiration scheme with inside the cell. As a matter of fact, pyruvic acid can only enter mitochondria when there is oxygen inside the cell. And then that oxygen becomes incorporated into this water molecule, along with some electrons and some hydrogens. So there are chemical compounds that take high-energy electrons from the Krebs cycle to the electron transport chain, and you know what some of these compounds are already. Does anybody remember what some of these molecules are that can carry high-energy electrons from one set of chemical reactions to another? Yeah, NAD+ and FADH2, because that's their job, right? And those are, what, coenzymes. So NADH and FADH2 carry electrons to electron transport chain. Under what kind of conditions? Under aerobic conditions. Okay, so let's look at some of the processes that we have right here. The first one is glycolysis. All right, so glycolysis is a metabolic pathway by which glucose is converted into two pyruvates. And how many carbons are in pyruvic acid? There are three, right? So glycolysis produces two pyruvates because glucose is basically just snipped in half. And is it aerobic respiration? Is it dependent on oxygen? Does not require oxygen. Where is it taking place? You can look at that previous slide. It's in the cytosol right here, right? So it doesn't require organelles in order for this to happen. Here's the overall net reaction. We have glucose, and we have 2 NAD+, and 2 ATP, and 2 inorganic phosphates, and at the end of glycolysis, we get 2 pyruvates, or 2 pyruvic acids, plus 2 NADHs, and what's being carried by this NADH right here? High energy electrons, right? And 2 ATP as well. So here's the overall reaction for glycolysis. And would this be an anabolic reaction in terms of glucose or a catabolic reaction? Yeah, it's catabolic because you're breaking glucose down into pyruvate. And what kind of reaction is that, endergonic or exergonic? That is exergonic, and that exergonic reaction can be coupled, right, to drive an endergonic reaction, namely what? The modification of ADP, adding an inorganic phosphate to it to make an ATP molecule. All right, but there's more energy lost in glucose being converted into pyruvic acid than energy gained when you join inorganic phosphate and ADP to make an ATP. All right, so glycolysis is, oh, you answered this question already. I should drop this slide from the presentation, right? It's exergonic. Produces 2 ATPs and 2 NADHs, so that energy is not lost. It just doesn't produce heat inside your body, but that energy that's released is used to make ATP and these NADHs. All right, but before glycolysis can take place, it has a fairly significant activation energy barrier. Even though enzymes are being used to regulate this process, it requires 2 ATPs, right? And so glucose has to be phosphorylated. What kind of enzyme will phosphorylate glucose? We kind of looked at that last time. It's a kinase, that's right. And it's going to be what? A glucose kinase enzyme, because it's going to phosphorylate glucose. And that inorganic phosphate is a highly ionized group. It's an acidic group. It's highly ionized, which means it is hydrophilic. And since it's a big hydrophilic group, now that glucose has been phosphorylated with 2 phosphates, can it get through the cell membrane? Because remember, the cell membrane is a phospholipid bilayer. It can't get through that phospholipid bilayer, so now this glucose is definitely trapped inside the cell. So that's the other use for phosphorylation right here. It traps the glucose inside most cells, because most cells don't have an enzyme to take a phosphate off of glucose. Can anybody remember the name of an enzyme that can take a phosphate off of something? It's used for dephosphorylation. That is a somebody said it someplace, it's a phosphatase, right? So kinase and phosphatases are antagonistic for what they're doing inside the cell. Okay, so here we have a glucose molecule, and we see that it's phosphorylated by using two ATPs, and in so doing, its free energy increases, so it's what? It's climbing over its activation energy barrier, and then it enters, and this is part of glycolysis, and then the molecule starts to break down. There are some rearrangements that have to take place. There are electrons that have to be transferred. For instance, here's a step that transfers a couple of electrons from an intermediate of glycolysis to NAD+, which then converts it into NADH. So this is what an oxidation reduction reaction. NAD going into NADH, that's a reduction reaction. That means one of these other metabolites is being oxidized when this happens. All right, and there are some other further steps where ATP is produced by enzymatic reactions. And then finally, you've got pyruvic acid right here. All right, so even though there are enzymes that regulate this reaction, right, this is exergonic because there is more energy in the reactants compared to the products right here, which is pyruvic acid. So you might want to look at what glycolysis really looks like. All right, so this is really what's happening. We have glucose that has six carbons. When it becomes phosphorylated, the sixth carbon gets that phosphate, right? So it turns into glucose 6-phosphate, and then it turns into fructose, so that's just an isomerization step. There's still six carbons in fructose. It just is a little bit different form of a sugar. And then fructose is phosphorylated on either end of the fructose molecule. And then fructose is split apart into these two phosphoglyceraldehyde molecules. Okay. And then between a few of these steps right here, right, this step between phosphoglyceraldehyde and biphosphoglyceric acid, some electrons can be lost, right? So then NADH is produced. So there are a lot of different intermediate steps right here. And sometimes I have people actually memorize all of these little steps, but I think maybe this semester I'm not going to do that. But it's a really good thing to do. And if you take biochemistry with Professor Landis, of course, you're going to have to know this forwards and backwards, right? Be able to draw it out. But probably not for this class. So I want you to know that glycolysis requires 2 ATP to get it started. But how many ATP are produced by the end? 4 are produced, but 2 are required to get it started. So what's the net production of ATP? It's only 2. But there's some other things that are produced that have energy associated with them, and that is NADH for oxidation reduction reactions. Okay, so basically here is your pyruvic acid with 3 carbons right here. All right, now because some of these steps, I see one arrow right here. Okay, what does that mean about this reaction? For instance, between this biphosphoglyceric acid and phosphoglyceraldehyde. Okay, it's freely reversible as long as you have NADH available or NAD+. Right, because not only do I see one arrow, I see another arrow going the right reverse direction. So glycolysis can run in the forward direction, producing pyruvic acid, or it can actually run in the reverse direction, producing glucose. How does your body know which way it should go? It's because of the law of mass action, that's one reason, or what we call Le Chatelier's principle. Right, so if we have a lot of glucose and very little pyruvic acid, then the reaction is going to go in the forward direction. But if you have a lot of pyruvic acid, it's going to force the reverse reaction to make glucose. It all depends on the balance of those steps right there. But in order to go in the forward direction, what do you need inside the cells? NAD or NADH? You need NAD. In order for glycolysis to work in the forward direction. If NADH builds up inside the cell, what's going to happen to glycolysis? It's going to be inhibited because if NADH builds up, it's going to want to try to force glycolysis to go in the reverse direction. Okay? The same thing for ATP and ADP. In order for glycolysis to work in the forward direction, there has to be ADP available. Right? If you only have ATP, that's going to try to force the reaction in the reverse direction by the law of mass action. So I think this the reason why I have the slide in here is so that you can see glycolysis can work in either direction depending on the balance of metabolites that are available. So a good question would be, what form should this NAD be in order for glycolysis to work in the forward direction? Should it be in the form of NAD or NADH? NAD, right? It's got to be in the form of NAD. Because if there's no NAD available, glucose can't be converted into pyruvic acid. Furthermore, if we can't convert glucose into pyruvic acid by glycolysis, what are we missing out on? ATP production, right? So in order to make these two measly ATPs by glycolysis, right, there has to be plenty of NAD available inside the cytosol in order for that reaction to take place. If you only have NADH, then glycolysis will shut down as a result. Okay, was there something else I wanted to say about this? Probably not. That's pretty good. Okay, so that describes the necessity of the lactic acid pathway. All right, so to avoid end product inhibition due to a buildup of NADH is produced by glycolysis, all right, under anaerobic conditions, NADH has to be converted back to NAD to keep glycolysis working in the forward direction. All right, so in the absence of oxygen, NADH gives its hydrogens to pyruvate, creating lactic acid. Right, we call this anaerobic respiration. Sometimes we call that fermentation. So fermentation is an anaerobic process. So here is the chemical formula for pyruvic acid, and here's an enzyme that can interconvert pyruvic acid and lactic acid. One thing to first notice is that how many carbon atoms are in pyruvic acid?
Three.
How many carbon atoms are in lactic acid? There are three. So there's no decarboxylation reaction taking place right here. There's still three carbon atoms. But look what happens. In order for pyruvic acid to be converted into lactic acid, what else is necessary? NADH. There has to be some high energy electrons along with this enzyme right here. And those high energy electrons then get placed in lactic acid. And so that gets rid of pyruvic acid so that end product inhibition can't take place. But it also does what? It resynthesizes NAD, and what's the importance of NAD? You need NAD in order for glycolysis to proceed, right? So under anaerobic conditions, let's go back to here. Under anaerobic conditions, right here, the production of lactic acid kind of ensures that glycolysis can still proceed in the cytosol, right? And what's the importance of that? And it's not on this slide. What's it producing? It's producing ATP, right? Okay, so this anaerobic respiration allows glycolysis to operate inside the cell under anaerobic conditions producing ATP. Now, how important is ATP? Really important. Did I ever give you some examples of how important that is? On various classes, I kind of get out of sync which class I'm talking with. Well, for instance, your brain needs ATP to maintain consciousness, to run all those sodium-potassium pumps. All right, so if we cut off blood supply to the brain, for instance, when your heart stops beating, blood stops going to the brain, and how long can you maintain consciousness? All right, because when oxygen's not going to the brain, the mitochondria are not producing ATP, only glycolysis is, which is not very much ATP. How long do you have of consciousness before you pass out? 2 seconds, maybe 3 seconds. Okay, you can hold your breath for longer than 2 or 3 seconds without passing out, but why is that? Because your heart is still pumping, right? It's still beating, it's still delivering blood to the brain if you hold your breath. But if your heart stops, blood stops going to the brain, 2 to 3 seconds, your brain runs out of ATP, you lose consciousness, and you pass out. Okay, but your brain also needs ATP to stay alive. Without blood going to the brain, how long do you have before your brain actually dies? 2 to 3 seconds, you pass out. Your brain is still alive, but how long does somebody have to start doing chest compressions to get some blood up to your brain, to preserve your brain, to keep your brain from dying? 2 to 3 minutes. Okay, so 2 to 3 seconds, you run out of ATP. After 2 to 3 seconds, you lose consciousness because your brain runs out of ATP. 2 to 3 minutes, your brain actually dies because it's depleted so much of ATP, it actually goes away. Can we restart somebody's brain once it dies? No, right? That's kind of an endpoint. Okay. All right, so that's how important ATP is in your body. Another way of thinking of it, a typical textbook person is about 70 kilograms. I don't know how many pounds that is. I should figure that out. All right, so let's compare it in terms of a percentage of your body weight, how much ATP you need to run everything inside your body for a whole day. And that is about 40 kilograms. You need 40 kilograms of ATP to stay alive, which is what, in terms of your body weight? Is it half? It's more than half of your body weight. So again, that just describes how important it is, right, for these respiratory pathways to produce ATP in your body because you need so much of it. It's not that you have to carry a suitcase of ATP around with you all day long, all right? It's just your body is set up so that when you break an ATP down, what happens? It gets built back up again, right? So instead of taking it out of the suitcase, your body builds ATP, 40 kilograms every single day. All right, so this lactic acid pathway can ensure that glycolysis will produce some ATP under what kind of conditions? Anaerobic conditions. Some organs can survive with anaerobic respiration. For instance, muscles can survive as long as they're not working. A heart could survive, but do you ever know somebody's heart to not work? A heart is working all the time, right? And maybe unless you're in an emergency operating room or something and you deliberately stop somebody's heart from contracting, you could preserve that heart. And for instance, the same way with brains, okay? Brains are using ATP all the time, but sometimes, right, somebody is induced into a coma, right, to protect their brain from damage. And when somebody's placed in a coma, then the brain isn't using so much ATP. You've probably heard of some conditions under those circumstances. Okay, so the lactic acid pathway yields only two ATPs for every glucose. Red blood cells are a kind of funny cell because they don't contain a nucleus, they don't contain mitochondria, they're filled with hemoglobin, and these enzymes, glycolytic enzymes, they can only make two ATPs from every glucose molecule, but that's enough for them, okay, because their job is pretty passive, transporting oxygen. Lactic acid pathway occurs in skeletal muscle when oxygen supply falls below a critical level, like when this muscle is exercising, and in heart muscle when it becomes ischemic, when it gets cut off from blood supply, but a heart still needs more ATP than can be delivered by glycolysis. So heart muscle will die without blood supply. All right, so during heavy exercise, some skeletal muscle can get some energy to contract, right? But under severe exercise, what happens to your muscle? Does it get stronger? Can you lift heavier weights when you're exercising? I mean, at the same time, in one day. Maybe after a period of a month with exercise, your muscles get stronger. But say you lift the dumbbell up one time, what happens to the second time? Gets a little bit harder, and then what happens? Gets a little bit harder. Okay, because what happens is aerobic respiration isn't producing ATP, only anaerobic respiration, which is what? Only two ATP. So muscle contraction gets weaker and weaker and weaker as you progress through your exercise. Okay. All right, here are some important terms that you have to know about. And they're spelled differently and pronounced differently, and they might look like they're the same. Right, and if you can't tell that they're spelled differently, then you have to get new glasses. That's all there is to it, all right? Because you're going to want to be able to answer some of these questions. So here we have glycogenesis, right, and glycogenolysis. These are different terms. Glycogenesis is the production of glycogen from its basic building block. What's the basic building block of glycogen? Glucose, right? So we take glucose, jam it together, we make glycogen, and the name of that process is what? Glycogenesis. It's the making of glycogen. And glycogenolysis, right? What is lysis right here? It's breaking down of glycogen, right? So that's taking glycogen and making what out of it? Glucose, right? So these are opposite processes inside your body. All right, so your body can store thousands of glucose molecules inside of a cell, and if there are thousands or millions of glucose molecules, what's going to happen to that cell? If you got millions of these glucose particles inside the cell, what's going to happen to it? It's going to start to swell up because water is going to diffuse in because it's low concentration inside the cell. All right, so that the way that cells solve that problem is that it takes those millions of molecules of glucose and it makes one molecule out of it. So that stops that osmotic gradient. It stops those cells from swelling up. Okay, so for osmotic reasons, cells can't store many free glucoses. Right? Instead, your cells store glucose as glycogen through the process of glycogenesis, and then that prevents that osmotic condition from developing. All right, so both skeletal muscle and the liver can store lots of glucose in the form of glycogen. Right? And when any of these cells need glucose for its metabolic purposes, then there are different enzymes that will break glycogen down into glucose to support respiration. So that's what we would call glycogenolysis. That clips a glucose out of glycogen as glucose 6-phosphate, right? And glucose 6-phosphate can't get through the cell membrane, so then this glucose is trapped inside the cell, and then it can support the respiratory processes of that cell, right? Because what can you tell me about that phosphate group? Is it hydrophilic or phobic? It's very hydrophilic. It likes to be in water. It hates to be in oil, right? Because it's an ionized group, so it can't get through the cell membrane. If that glucose wants to get through the cell membrane, or if your body wants to export glucose, there has to be an enzyme that takes this phosphate off of glucose. What would that enzyme be? That, in particular, it would be glucose 6-phosphatase, because a kinase adds a phosphate. A phosphatase takes it off. All right, so let's view some other processes that are happening. All right, so put your reading glasses on. Glycolysis, what does it do? It converts glucose into pyruvate. It breaks glucose down. Okay. Glycogenesis, what does it do? It takes glucoses, joins them together to make glycogen. Okay. And glycogenolysis, what does that do? Takes glycogen, breaks it down into glucose, or if you want to say maltose, first the disaccharide form, but eventually to glucose. That's glycogenolysis. And then here's one that I only talked about, but I didn't define for you, gluconeogenesis. All right, neogenesis means what? The new formation of, or the new building of what? Glucose. How could you make new glucose in your body? By looking at glycolysis, but run it in which direction? The reverse direction, taking two pyruvates, join them together to make a glucose, right? So when we take two pyruvate or maybe two lactate molecules and make glucose out of it, we call that gluconeogenesis, right? So you should have the meanings on the tip of your tongue for these four processes right here. And it's not too bad because a lot of these processes are just the reverse of the other, right? Okay, let's look at these right here. Lipogenesis. What's lipo stand for? Lipid. Lipogenesis is the formation of, in particular, triglycerides. How would you make a triglyceride? Glycerol and three fatty acids, yeah, join them together, you got a nice triglyceride. And lipolysis is the reverse direction. It's the breaking down of a triglyceride into three fatty acids and glycerol, okay? And so you should know which one is hydrolysis and which one is a dehydration synthesis reaction. Ketogenesis, I might talk about that one sometime later. Okay. But you should know these two right here. So lipolysis, let's go over. What does lipolysis do one more time? Breaks down a triglyceride into three fatty acids and glycerol. That's lipolysis. Furthermore, these fatty acids can be broken down into some building blocks, and that's not what we call lipolysis. Breaking down of fatty acids, which is a catabolic process that releases energy, kind of like glycolysis right here, right, is what we call beta oxidation, and that's the last thing that we're going to talk about in this chapter. So beta oxidation is different than lipolysis. Lipolysis breaks down triglycerides, and then the breakdown products of lipolysis, which would be fatty acids, can be further broken down by beta oxidation. So these are related processes, but not exactly the same. Okay, so let's use some of these definitions right here. Let's look at the figure. So here we have a cell, and this cell could be in any number of different organs, so depending. So here we have glucose inside the cell, and it's in the form of glucose 6-phosphate. Can this glucose 6-phosphate leave the cell? No, it's trapped, right? Can't get through the cell membrane. All right, but if there is glucose 6-phosphatase, we find that only in the liver, right? Then glucose 6-phosphate can be converted into just free glucose, and then glucose can be secreted from the cell, picked up by the blood to increase blood glucose levels. So you might want to just jot down glucose 6-phosphatase right here. All right, so that's one possible fate for glucose 6-phosphate. There are a number of other fates. If the cell has a lot of ATP, if it's rich in energy, this glucose 6-phosphate can be converted into glucose 1. That's probably not so important for you to know. But this glucose 1-phosphate can be dephosphorylated, and it can be added to a growing glycogen molecule. All right, so what do we call this step number one right here when glucose 1-phosphate gets converted into glycogen? What do we call that process right here? This is important to write down. Glycogenesis. Yeah, that's glycogenesis, right? That's the making of glycogen. And what kind of molecule takes this phosphate off? Phosphatase. So a phosphatase makes this glycogen molecule. All right, but if this cell was low on energy, if it needed glucose, it could go to glycogen, and it could do what? Snip off glucose from glycogen, and in so doing, you would need what kind of enzyme? A kinase, right? Adds a phosphate to glucose, and then you end up back here with glucose 1-phosphate again. What do we call this process, number two? Glycogenolysis, right? The lysis of glycogen. Nice. Okay, that sounds pretty good. I got a feeling you're understanding what I'm talking about, but I don't know. Maybe, did you talk about this in lab yet? I don't think so. Okay. So pay attention to these. It's easy to get these terms mixed up. All right, but now here we have glucose 6-phosphate, and that can be converted into fructose and then finally pyruvate. What would we call this pathway, taking glucose and converting it into pyruvate? That would be glycolysis. Yeah, that would be the breaking down of glucose. Okay, and if it just runs in the reverse direction, say we have pyruvate and we run it in the reverse direction to make glucose, that would be gluconeogenesis, right? Gluconeogenesis. You might have to say that out loud a bunch of times. All right, so this cell right here, if it's a liver, can secrete glucose because it has the phosphatase, but if it's a muscle cell, it's missing this enzymatic step, so as soon as glucose gets inside the cell, it becomes phosphorylated by glucose kinase, and the glucose is trapped inside the cell, and then its only possible fate is to become glycogen or to be metabolized to make ATP by glycolysis. All right. Let's compare a couple different organs and how they can communicate with each other using these processes right here. And this is an exam figure. I think maybe this was an exam figure too. I'm not sure. Okay. But this one for sure is. This is the Cori cycle, right? And it involves gluconeogenesis and glycolysis and glycogenolysis and all those processes that we were talking about. Okay. Skeletal muscle, when it's exercising, right, converts pyruvic acid into lactic acid. Pyruvate can't leave the cell, but lactic acid can leave skeletal muscle cells. So when it leaves a skeletal muscle cell, goes into the blood, goes everywhere in the body, including the liver. And the liver is pretty cool because it can take that lactate, convert it back to pyruvate, and then it can take a couple pyruvates and make glucose out of it again. All right, so let's look at this Cori cycle. Let's start here in a skeletal muscle. We have glucose 6-phosphate. It has a couple different fates depending on whether this skeletal muscle is exercising. If this is exercising, what molecule is necessary for muscle contraction? ATP. Not necessarily glucose, but how can we convert glucose into ATP? By taking glucose, snipping it in half, making pyruvic acid out of it. What do we call number two? That's glycolysis, right? So number two is glycolysis, and so doing it produces some ATP so that the muscle still can contract, all right? But under anaerobic conditions, pyruvic acid cannot enter the mitochondria like we saw on that first slide, and so pyruvic acid then is converted into lactic acid. Lactic acid can leave the cell, all right? But I think you should know the name of that enzyme that converts pyruvic acid to lactic acid. It's not a metabolic pathway because it's just a single step. Unlike glycolysis, which is what? Is it one step? No, it was that big nightmare of steps that you saw, that you said, oh, thanks, that I didn't have to memorize every single step, right? But the conversion of pyruvic acid to lactic acid is just a single step, so it's not a metabolic pathway, it's an enzyme. That's called lactic acid, lactic dehydrogenase, LDH. Let's go back. Right here, LDH. Yeah, lactic acid dehydrogenase. Yeah, you could put LDH right here. Lactic acid can leave this muscle cell, go into the blood, liver can pick it up, and because the free energy, there's not much free energy change between lactic acid and pyruvic acid right here, this is a freely reversible reaction. So the liver can convert lactic acid into pyruvic acid if there's more lactic acid available. And you also need what? NADH. No, you need NAD to be converted to NADH. The liver can make pyruvic acid. And then what is 6 over here? Taking two pyruvic acids and making a glucose out of it. What is that called? That is, it has to do with glucose. So it's glucose something is what? Making new glucose. That is gluconeogenesis is number 6. Okay, and if this muscle is still exercising, this liver might agree to donate the glucose to these cells. So then you need number 7 right here. You need a glucose 6 phosphatase to take the phosphate off so glucose can go into the blood and can be taken up by this skeletal muscle cell once again. All right, and then it can be used by glycolysis to make some ATP to keep this muscle cell contracting. But if this muscle cell is at rest, let's consider what's happening now, right? If the muscle cell's at rest, doesn't need as much ATP, so glycolysis is not so important that we keep that open. What can the cell do with glucose when the cell is at rest? Store it for when it starts to exercise. And what's the name of the process by which this cell can store glucose? Glycogenesis. So number 9 is glycogenesis. It makes glycogen until it starts exercising once again. All right, back over here, right, the liver might realize that this muscle cell is content. It doesn't need glucose, so it's glucose. The liver cell wants to keep its own glucose. So instead of a glucose 6 phosphatase, right, what's happening here? The liver cell will make its own glycogen. All right, so, and then what do we call that process? That's the same as number 9 over here, right? That is glycogenesis. And then if there's a metabolic demand someplace in the body, the liver can break down glycogen into glucose, and that's the same as number 1 over here in the muscle cell, and that is what? Glycogenolysis. Right, and then this liver cell can secrete glucose. So only the liver cells have that glucose 6 phosphatase that can donate glucose to the blood to support respiration in other cells. Okay, so Cori cycle is pretty important. All right, so where are we so far? Oops. All right, so we looked at glucose right here, talked about the lactic acid pathway under anaerobic conditions and how skeletal muscle interrelates with liver function right here. We looked at the three processes like glycolysis, gluconeogenesis, right, glycogenolysis, and the reverse of glucose, right, the reverse of glucose production is what? The making of glycogen, and that is glycogenesis. All right, so make sure that you can spell those terms out and that you can recognize them. All right, so, oh, another possible fate for pyruvic acid. Under aerobic conditions, it can enter the mitochondria, and it can enter 3 more chemical reactions. One is a preparatory reaction, the second is the Krebs cycle, and then the third is electron transport. Okay, and when that happens, CO2 is produced and oxygen is produced. All right, so under anaerobic conditions means what? You need oxygen, so what does your body have to do? You have to inhale to get oxygen to what organelle in order for this to happen? Mitochondria need oxygen, all right? And why do you exhale? Because, you want to get rid of CO2. What organelle produces CO2? mitochondria, right? So that's something else that you see on this particular slide right here. Oxygen is not necessary in the cytosol, and CO2 is not produced in the cytosol. It's this mitochondria right here. All right, so let's look at some of these aerobic pathways, right? And where do they happen? What's the organelle that we have aerobic pathways? Mitochondria, okay. All right, so here we have pyruvic acid, and instead of being converted into lactic acid, because oxygen is present, it can enter the mitochondria. And it can combine with a coenzyme. What the heck is a coenzyme again? Large organic molecule. That's all you got to know about it. That's going to carry some other molecule from one set of reactions to another, right? And coenzyme A, probably the first coenzyme somebody started to look at with a lot of rigor. So you could have called it coenzyme 1, but this is just coenzyme A. Pyruvic acid is going to combine with coenzyme A, and it's going to be coupled with an oxidation reduction reaction. So NAD plus is going to be reduced into NADH. So there's some electrons that are donated from pyruvic acid. And in so doing, pyruvic acid is going to be decarboxylated. So here's that carboxyl group. It's going to be decarboxylated. So you're left with CO2, right, inside the mitochondria. But now you have this two-carbon fragment right here attached to coenzyme A. This S is a part of coenzyme A. This two-carbon fragment is called an acetyl group. All right, so this is what we call acetyl-CoA because of this two-carbon fragment. Acetyl-CoA is then carried to the Krebs cycle, and this acetyl group then is donated to the Krebs cycle. All right, so this is what I call the preparatory reaction. The preparatory reaction produces CO2, but also an important energy metabolite, which is, what's an important energy metabolite right here? NADH. And NADH is carrying high energy electrons that can be used to do some work inside of our cells. Okay, so that's important, this NADH. And then, of course, we just get rid of that CO2. Okay, so here's a pretty good example. Here is the mitochondrial membrane. So here's cytosol, here's the inside the mitochondria. Pyruvic acid enters. When can pyruvic acid enter a mitochondria? Under what kind of conditions? It's got to be aerobic conditions, right? Because under aerobic conditions, right, we have NAD available. Under anaerobic conditions, we don't have a lot of NAD available, so pyruvic acid can't enter. Here's that preparatory reaction, where there's a first decarboxylation reaction. So we got an acetyl group, or C2. That joins with the Krebs cycle. And it's the Krebs cycle starts with a four-carbon molecule, and when you add two carbons to it, what does that molecule become? A six-carbon molecule, right? And then it's going to be converted via some two steps of decarboxylation reactions right here. So what happens to this six-carbon molecule? It goes back down to a four-carbon. And so this four-carbon then gets regenerated by the Krebs cycle so that it can rejoin with this acetyl group. So this Krebs cycle can just keep churning and churning and churning as long as there is oxygen available for it to work. All right, so again, mitochondria produce what? Carbon dioxide. But we need to look in a little bit more detail within the Krebs cycle right here. The preparatory reaction makes an NADH, but also the Krebs cycle produces some things. And I don't want you to memorize everything that's going on here, but some important salient features. Here you have that two-carbon group, which we call that acetyl group, okay, brought into the Krebs cycle by acetyl-CoA. It makes this six-carbon group right here, and then there's some interconversions and a decarboxylation reaction. And look what happens at this decarboxylation reaction, just like this preparatory reaction. We have NAD being reduced to NADH. And what's the job of NADH again? It carries high energy electrons from one chemical reaction, like the Krebs cycle, to another set of chemical reactions. We're going to work with NADH in just a little bit. All right, then the Krebs cycle produces, proceeds. We've got another decarboxylation reaction, which produces what? Another NADH, okay? And then here's kind of a fancy reaction right here. Okay, you don't have to know that alpha-ketoglutaric acid gets converted to succinate over here, and in so doing, right, guanosine diphosphate is converted into guanosine triphosphate. Right, that's a high-energy molecule, just like ATP. So GTP can be used to convert ADP into an ATP, right, because there's no free energy change right here. So in the Krebs cycle, we see immediately that it's producing two NADHs and one ATP. But in this step, it also then reduces FAD to FADH2. So FADH2 is another high-energy molecule that's carrying some high-energy electrons. Right, we're going to do that. We're going to deal with that in just a little bit. And then to regenerate the four-carbon molecule, fortunately, NADH can be converted into another NADH right here. It can be reduced into NADH. So for one turn of the Krebs cycle, you need this acetyl group entering. That's going to produce how many carbon dioxides? Two carbon dioxides. And through that catabolic process, how many NADs are produced for one turn of the Krebs cycle?
Three.
One, two, three NADHs, and then don't forget about one FADH2, and then what we're all very thirsty for is one ATP molecule. Okay. The production of ATP in the Krebs cycle is very similar to the production of ATP in glycolysis. Sorry about flipping back really fast. Okay. Production of ATP in glycolysis is just due to an enzymatic reaction. All right, and because of that, because an enzyme is involved in making ATP from ADP in glycolysis and the Krebs cycle, right, we call it substrate level phosphorylation. Because what does an enzyme need to make a product? It needs a substrate, right? So we call this substrate level phosphorylation. In glycolysis, how many ATP are produced by substrate level phosphorylation? Two, right, in a net form, two ATP. Right? In the Krebs cycle, how much ATP is produced for every one term by substrate level phosphorylation?
One.
One, okay, in this step right here. All right, so that's substrate level. We're going to talk about another form of ATP synthesis or production, right, in another part of the mitochondria that requires high energy electrons. Oh my goodness, high energy electrons. Where are you going to get high energy electrons from to make ATP? Oh, well, that's right, I forgot. We got NADH right here, and we got some what? FADH2, right? So mitochondria still can make more ATP as a result of these compounds that are produced by the Krebs cycle. Okay. So, and that is the electron transport chain. Okay, and we call it electron transport chain because, why? Because it's transporting high energy electrons from one molecule to another. All right, so if a molecule receives an electron, what's happening to it? It's becoming reduced. All right, and what happens to the molecule that's donating those electrons? It's becoming oxidized, right? And they're always paired reaction. One can't happen without the other, okay? Pretty much by definition for obvious reasons. So, the electron transport chain is involved with oxidative phosphorylation, which is different than substrate level phosphorylation. Where does substrate level phosphorylation happen once again? Krebs cycle and glycolysis. Okay, oxidative phosphorylation happens as a result of the electron transport chain inside mitochondria under what kind of conditions? Aerobic conditions. Let me show you why it's aerobic conditions first. Okay, so here we have NADH, and we're going to plot this out versus the free energy versus the progress of the reaction through the electron transport chain. So what's the highest energy molecule that we see in this whole mess right here? We got NADH, right, because it's carrying these high energy electrons. These electrons can be transferred to another molecule that's embedded in the mitochondrial membrane, the inner membrane of the mitochondria. Remember, the mitochondria has an inner membrane. What did we call the inner membrane of the mitochondria? The Christi membrane, right? So all of these compounds are embedded in the Christi membrane. NADH bumps into them, transfers some electrons into FMN, reducing it, converting it into FMNH2. You don't have to particularly know any of these compounds. Okay, and then FMNH2 will bump into another compound, okay, which is a cytochrome Q or coenzyme Q. All right, and in so doing, this is what a nice oxidation reduction reaction. And at this step, then the mitochondria can make another ATP molecule. Okay, coenzyme Q can also accept electrons directly from FADH. All right, but if FADH comes in and donates electrons to coenzyme Q, it misses this step right here. All right, so if we start the electron transport chain with NADH, how many ATPs can be made? Three. But if high energy electrons are donated from FADH2, how many ATPs can be made? Only two, because the electrons in FADH2 don't have the same amount of energy that you can see on the energy diagram over here. All right, so flowing through all of these different cytochromes, like you have cytochrome B and C and C1, all right, these are just special kinds of molecules that can easily be oxidized and reduced. All right, so these electrons will flow through all these different cytochromes, but there has to be a molecule that's going to accept these electrons down over here. All right, if these electrons build up inside the mitochondria, what happens to the flow of electrons through ETC, or electron transport chain? It stops. And if the flow of electrons stops through ETC, what happens to ATP production? It stops, right? Not a good thing. So these electrons have to end up someplace, and where do they end up? They end up being accepted by oxygen, okay, combining with some protons right here to make water. So a nice question would be, what's the very last molecule that's produced by the electron transport chain? It's just water. It's kind of amazing. So water is an important metabolite in many chemical reactions, but it's also the solvent that our body is dissolved in. So when you take oxygen away, what happens to electron transport chain? It stops, and then no ATP is produced by what kind of process? Oxidative phosphorylation. Well, we got to stop. And on Thursday, I'll finish up some thoughts on oxidative phosphorylation, compare it to substrate level, and look at some more things inside the mitochondria. And there was a sign-in sheet going around someplace.